This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening. Welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
Tell the world that Malawi has a big problem regarding the natural disaster that has befallen us.
That's Minister of Homeland Security in Malawi, Nicholas Dawusi, on the country's plea for help after Cyclone Idai. Details coming up. Also, Algeria has announced that President Abdelaziz Bouteflika will resign before his mandate expires on April 28th. And Kenya's Garissa University is marking 4 years since Al-Shabaab militant attack claimed 148 lives. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, Malawi has appealed for international aid for nearly a million people affected by floods from Cyclone Idai. Authorities say people in cyclone-affected areas are in dire need of food, water, shelter and sanitation. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
Malawi's appeal is for aid targeting 162,000 households in areas worst hit by cyclones Idai's flooding waters. Official figures show the cyclone killed 60 people, injured more than 600, and displaced hundreds of thousands, many to temporary camps. Minister of Homeland Security in Malawi, Nicholas Dawusi, says they are in dire need of food, shelter, and sanitation.
Our intention is to tell the world that Malawi has a big problem regarding the natural disaster that has befallen us. It's an appeal to both monetary and humanitarian assistance, to the international world, even people of goodwill, to come for an assistance. There is desperation in the camps.
Malawi's Department of Disaster Management says the country needs about $43 million for cyclone relief, but Malawi authorities say they have secured half of that amount. Catherine Boza is a flood-displaced villager in Chiwawa district. She says there are problems at the camp because of food shortages. They were initially given maize flour in a cup of water to cook porridge, says Boza, and later were given a plate of maize flour. Recently, she says, they have been given 2 basins of maize flour, but most of the time, says Boza, they sleep without eating anything. Flood victim Paul Mandiamba says most of the assistance they have received is from politicians running for office in the upcoming May elections. He says when they come with a bag of maize, they tell us to eat together in a group. This is not practical, says Mandiamba, because some of us have 4 children, while others have 5 children. It is still not enough. In many areas in Malawi's East Bank, providing cyclone relief aid is still a problem because of damaged roads and bridges. Maria Jose Torres is a country coordinator for the United Nations Development Programme. She says efforts are being made to help Malawi meet the needs of flood-affected people.
The United Nations is working towards implementing the plan, and we are already mobilizing from our Central Emergency Response Fund that is based in New York, $3.2 million, and acknowledging that actually it's not enough, but we will continue with the efforts to bring more attention.
Cyclone Idai hit central Mozambique in early March, swamping entire villages with heavy rains that flooded parts of southern Malawi and Zimbabwe. Malawi President Peter Mutharika in early March declared half of the country's districts disaster areas. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
And in Mozambique, hundreds of thousands of people have been forced out of their homes by Cyclone Idai. Reporter Mohamed Yusuf is in Beira and takes us to a new shelter for many of the storm's victims.
We are in one of the newly temporary built shelters in the city of Beira. This accommodation is filled with women and children. We can see people registering to receive solar lamps distributed by the United Nations Refugee Agency, UNHCR. Most of these people come from Nyamatanda and Dondo and Buzi district. Beira City is hosting more than 150,000 displaced people. With such huge population with little food and clean water, medical agencies have confirmed 950 cholera cases. Aid agencies say they are doing their best to contain the disease and stop cholera. Cyclone Idai hit Mozambique in mid-March. The storm and the floodings has claimed the lives of more than 500 people. According to the government officials, more than 1.8 million people in Mozambique are affected. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Beira, Mozambique.
Algeria has announced that President Abdelaziz Bouteflika will resign before his mandate expires on April 28th. The statement said the ailing leader would take steps to ensure state institutions continue to function during the transition period. The announcement yesterday was received with some joy, but there was a little euphoria, as protesters insisted the whole ruling system must change. Under the Constitution, if the president steps down, the Speaker of the Upper House of the Parliament serves as interim leader for up to 90 days, during which a presidential election must be organized. The 82-year-old Bouteflika has been in a wheelchair since suffering a stroke in 2013. Protests erupted when he announced he would seek a fifth term, but he later backed down. Marina Ottaway, a Middle East fellow at the Woodrow Wilson Center, spoke to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi about the complicated political crisis problem in Algeria following that announcement.
Well, we don't know if it's really Bouteflika who issued the statement. Nobody knows his personal role in this. But it's quite clear that this is an attempt by the regime to maintain control over the transition. They are trying to make sure that the transition does not lead to the coming to power of people close to the protesters, or at least people who are not part of the present regime. So I think from the point of view of those who would like to change, the idea that the transition has to take place through the institutions, it's ominous, because it means that the regime is still determined not to allow any change to take place.
The announcement was received with some joy. However, there was little sign of euphoria as protesters insisted that the whole ruling system must change. Could such a demand push the army to intervene and repeat the Egyptian experience?
Well, that is always the possibility. And the problem with knowing what the military is going to do in all countries is always very difficult, because the military is never a transparent organization. At the same time, if the transition takes place within the old institutions, there is not going to be any transition at all. There is going to be a new figurehead instead of Bouteflika, but there is not going to be a new type of government, a more open government. So it's a very difficult situation, because if the demonstrators push too hard, it may lead to the intervention of the open intervention of the army. And if they don't push enough, they'll find themselves with the same regime minus Bouteflika.
But under the Algerian constitution, if the president resignation is tendered, the speaker of the upper house of the Algerian parliament would act as interim leader for up to 90 days, during which a presidential election must be organized. What are the different scenarios that could emerge in Algeria?
To me, the most optimistic scenario is one that looks like the Tunisian scenario, where the formation of a broad committee of sort, of a broad national convention of sort, in which not only people close to the government, but also representatives of other organizations, of the protesters, but particularly of the organized groups that have started participating in the protest. For example, the judges participated as judges, the lawyers participated as lawyers, and so on. What the country needs, in fact, is a very broad national dialogue, but not a national dialogue the way the government wants it, which would be a very restricted dialogue, strictly to amend the constitution, but a true national dialogue. And that might yet happen if the demonstrations continue on a massive scale. It's an interesting issue about how much the army would dare to go against the very clearly manifested public opinion that they wanted a broad process. There are a lot of unknowns. I mean, if I were to take a bet, I would say no more 50% chance of such broad coalition emerging, perhaps less than that. But I think that would be the best case scenario for Algeria. Otherwise, it's going to be either a military takeover or a return to the old regime without Bouteflika.
That was Marina Ottaway, a Middle East fellow at the Woodrow Wilson Center, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi. Sixteen past the hour, you were listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Kenya's Garissa University is marking 4 years since Al-Shabaab militant attack claimed 148 lives, most of them students, while the Somali terrorist group has carried out numerous assaults since then. It remains their deadliest attack inside Kenya. Rael Ambur reports from Nairobi.
24-year-old Vitalis Opio is a carpenter in Nairobi, but in 2015, he was studying to be a teacher at Garissa University when militants attacked. Opio says early on April 2nd that year, he heard what sounded like gunshots, and after some minutes, the sound of people screaming. His two roommates ran outside to see what was happening. It was the last time Opio saw them alive.
After they had dealt with the people outside, they started moving door to door, for which they got into my room. But by then, I had to hide behind the door. The way you open the door this way, the other side, at the back of the door, I just stood there still. So they got in, but maybe I was lucky. It was just by God's grace I survived. They didn't see me. Yeah.
Al-Shabaab terrorists killed 148 people at Garissa University, almost all of them students. The university took 9 months to reopen, but now has 1,500 students, more than double the number in 2015. Vice Chancellor Ahmed Osman Warfa said they have healed from the tragedy.
We have moved on because of resilience, because of our marketing strategies, and because of what we have done. That has brought a lot of students back to the university. We have put up a perimeter wall, and then we have also established a police post, which houses 30 officers.
After security increased at sites of the previous attacks, Al-Shabaab hit a softer target this year on January 15. The attack on Nairobi's Dusit D2 hotel and office complex killed 21 people. But Kenyan security forces responded quickly and were given credit for keeping the death toll down compared to previous attacks. Political analyst and lecturer at Aga Khan University in Nairobi, Sam Kamau, agreed.
We used to see an coordinated response that also used to take a bit long. But I think if you remember what happened recently with the Dusit attack, even if we lost lives, I think the number of people who were rescued and the way the whole issue was handled in terms of communication, in terms of the time of response, I think the security forces have learned important lessons.
Despite improved security, for survivors like Opio, the threat of Al-Shabaab attacks remains a reality for which Kenya must always be prepared. Rael Ombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
As the 25th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide approaches on Sunday, we are bringing you a series of deeply moving profiles of men, women, and children who survived that terrible time. They are talking about the lives they lost, the lives they have found, and their hope for a new and better Rwanda. Today in the Survivors series, let's hear from Nzimana Daidone, who was only 12 when he lost his mother and two siblings in the genocide. He and another rescued kids were taken to an orphanage, but he left and became a street kid in Kigali for several months until he was taken to another orphanage, which helped him study to become a pharmacist. While he says he's happy as a 37-year-old husband and father of two, he says most people don't know he is furious, but hides it as best as he can.
I remember many things, but one that I cannot forget is the death of my two young sisters. I always think I'll see them again someday. I heard that they died, but I never saw their bodies. People told me they'd been exhumed from mass graves, but I never saw them personally. I always think that when I wake up one morning, I'll meet them. Of all things that happened during the genocide, this is what remains intense in my heart. The reason this memory remains fresh in my mind is that shortly before genocide broke out, my 7-year-old and 3.5-year-old sisters and I were together somewhere. We'd visited some people in a certain home. I saved my life and left them there. I always think they may have continued to live even after I left them. Unfortunately, reliable sources confirmed that they were killed and that their bodies were exhumed from mass graves. So I always feel that there's a mission I've failed to accomplish. I was their elder brother, and I was supposed to look after them. Even though I didn't have the ability to save them, my heart always throws that guilt back to me. I was 12 years when genocide ended, and I had nobody to rely on. I had no one to take care of me, and I found myself in Savi Orphanage, which was located in former Ngoma commune. Life was tough there. I spent only 1 week in the orphanage. Then colleagues of my age and I decided to go to Kigali. I knew nobody there. I normally crack a joke and say I'm a former street child in Kigali who now owns his own house in the same Kigali. I wandered into families, but I ended up in a religious orphanage that raised me until I finished my university studies. I own a home, and I'm a father of two children. First of all, forgiveness relieves the one who forgives than it does to the one forgiven. I accepted what happened to us, that our loved ones were killed by either people we didn't know or the people we knew. Our hearts are clean. We forgive them, even though some of them didn't ask for forgiveness. Others don't even acknowledge their crimes. We forgive them in order to have our hearts relieved and live a smooth life. A reconciled nation is a country where its citizens live in harmony without any form of segregation, whether it's based on race, tribe, hate, or origin. A country that offers equal opportunity to all citizens without nepotism or favoritism. A country that unites its citizens and provides them with the means so as to develop together, building their nation.
Nzumana Dieudonne, a survivor of Rwanda's genocide 25 years ago. A Kenyan teacher who won this year's $1 million US dollar Global Teacher Prize in Dubai received a rock star welcome home. Peter Tabichi, a science teacher and Franciscan brother, returned to his rural school in Kenya over the weekend after receiving the coveted award. VOA's Ruben Chama reports from Njoro in Kenya's Nakuru County.
There was pomp and color everywhere. At Keriko Secondary School, where Tabichi teaches physics and mathematics, thousands filled the dusty playground to see their hero. John Wangai is the school's deputy principal.
It's a great feat. So this was a situation of disbelief, a situation where you could not imagine that it's Keriko of all the schools. It is Mokaya of all the teachers. I think about thousands of teachers who had applied. Talking about the first African to have got this award. With great happiness, with jubilation, we are excited. Right now, even the whole village, the whole of Pwani, the whole of Njoro, we are talking about this great teacher who has brought glory to Keriko Secondary School, who has brought glory to the whole of the county, and by extension, the whole of the Republic.
The 36-year-old teacher was named winner of the Global Teacher Prize in Dubai last week. On his arrival, Tabichi told a cheering crowd that he was delighted to be back home with the trophy.
I feel so excited to be back to my school where I teach.
What difference do you think the award presents to the community?
To the community, I'm very sure it's going to transform the lives of the community, the learners, teachers. It is going to raise the status of the teaching profession. It shows that teachers matter, and therefore I'm happy that lives of my learners and other people in the community are going to be transformed.
With this win, Tabichi has brought recognition not only to his school, but also to the entire nation. Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta hosted him at State House Nairobi and termed him an inspiration to the society. Gerishon Mongai, one of Tabichi's students, was in the jubilant crowd.
We are glad and excited because of the victory that Mr. Tabichi have brought to us. We thank everyone who participated in the affair. Special thanks goes to the Almighty God who have granted us the victory, and we hope that this victory will make us go far.
Another student, Lucy Karanja, says she's glad to welcome Brother Tabichi back to school.
For the award that Brother Mokaya won, it will really help our school to improve the status of our schools. As you can see, the classes are not enough for the students, and also the laboratory is not well equipped. So we hope that Brother Mukai will help us in building the classes and equipping our laboratory.
Born into a farming family of six, Lucy wants to become a doctor one day. Our family sells crops such as maize and beans to pay her school fees. Established in 2007, the school is located in a remote village in Nakuru County, about 185 kilometers from Nairobi. The area is semi-arid, its electricity supply is unreliable, and it lacks running water. Most of the school's 475 students are from underprivileged backgrounds, and some are orphaned. Tabichi's fellow teachers and friends also praised him for his dedication. Elijah Kebene is a teacher at the school.
He has encouraged us about integrating ICT with our lessons in a bid to make learning interesting, in a bid to make learners relate what they are being taught in class and what happens outside or in the real world.
The $1 million award is presented every year to a teacher who has made an outstanding contribution to their profession. Tabichi, who dedicates 80% of his $400 monthly salary to his students, was awarded the prize for his dedication and hard work. Ruben Chama, VOA News, reporting from Njoro, Kenya.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehis Wuhib in Washington.
This is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On April 7th, the United Nations marks the 25th anniversary of the genocide in Rwanda. More than 800,000 people, mostly Tutsi, were killed. An in-depth discussion of what Rwanda and the world has learned from this tragedy on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the Sunny Side of Sports, Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.